When I was in high school, I remember reading Nathaniel Hawthorne's classic, The Scarlet Letter. And though it's never been one of my favorites, I'm not terribly fond of Hawthorne's literary style, if all must be said. It left a huge impression on me at a time before I had any clue I'd be a Unitarian Universalist one day, with a clear lesson on what happens when a community becomes moralistic and overly judgmental. Set in a Puritan community in 1642, Hawthorne tells the story of Hester Prynne, a young woman who conceives a child in an adulterous affair and is condemned by her neighbors in the Massachusetts Bay Colony to wear a scarlet letter A on her dress in order to visibly bear the mark of her sin. Now, this is despite the fact that Hester chooses to live a fairly quiet life out on the edge of town, earning a meager living through her needlework and generally not bothering anyone. In fact, Hester leads a life of selflessness, helping the poor and sick, and generally making the village a better place to live. None of this is enough for the villagers, though, who can only see Hester as a sinner and cannot see the good she is doing in the world. She refuses to name her lover, and this, combined with her adultery, makes her an outcast in their world. I think I remember the book because I felt like Hester at some time in my life, though obviously the circumstances have been a little different. Judged by those who, for one reason or another, felt superior to me by labeling me a sinner. I wonder if this is a universal experience, if we've all had times when we were on the receiving end of those who would rather worry about the beam in our eyes before they worry about the same as theirs, to paraphrase Jesus. If we compared stories, would we all have something to contribute? Some memory of being cast to the edge of society and forced to become outcasts. Now, it's easy to view this sort of experience as something other people do. What Unitarian Universalists often forget, though, is that the Puritans are our direct religious predecessors, direct parents of our own movement, and creators of the congregational polity our religious movement holds so dear. Such legalism is not just a Puritan issue. It's a human issue. As people struggle with how to treat those they disagree with, often on issues they see as intractable, Unitarian Universalism has succumbed to it just as much as other religions. So I think it behooves us to think about acceptance of one another, and how we are to understand it. And as we examine our third principle this month, acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth, I want to ask some provocative questions this morning, inspired by a question from a Time for All Ages a couple months ago. I promised I'd get back to that question. How would we respond if a white nationalist joined our congregation? What about a pedophile or a convicted rapist? What if that white nationalist wanted to fill in for me on Sunday morning to provide a so-called balance to my anti-racist sermons, or to spout their views during congregational conversation or joys and concerns? How do we handle these situations? Well, some people in progressive circles have adopted a version of a saying that, if you read the title of my service on the order of service today, you'll know what I think of it already. Love the sinner, hate the sin. It expresses their desire that they will still love a person despite their beliefs or lifestyle. On the surface, it may seem this is the right way to go. After all, Unitarian Universalism promotes a belief in the inherent worth and dignity of all persons. If there's a way to separate the person from their actions, maybe we can still accept white supremacists and pedophiles without condoning their action. This seems to have been the intention of the phrase as it was originally written. Its author was actually St. Augustine, and it seemed a straightforward statement. The sin is what we should be focused on, not the person committing it. Yet there's problems with this solution, the biggest of which was explained by Indian political activist Mahatma Gandhi, who is very critical of the phrase. In his autobiography, he writes, "Hate the sin and not the sinner is a precept which, though easy to understand, is rarely practiced. And that is why the poison of hatred spreads in the world." Yes, there's a reason that the saying is to love your neighbor as yourself, not to love sinners as yourself. It's hard to empathize with someone we've labeled. Those who use the phrase love the sinner, not the sin, may well have good intentions, but they've turned the other person into an other, an object different from us, and not simply a person with flaws, just like everyone else. Seeing people whom society has judged as drudges as neighbors rather than sinners reminds us that we are all not so different and that we need one another, no matter what we've done wrong in the past. What we're called to reject is the system that encourages division, the sin, not the sinner, the people who are caught up in the system. That is why so often you'll hear me talk about white supremacy instead of white supremacists, sexism instead of sexists, ableism and not ableists, and yes, sin, but not sinners. The isms are the systems, the is labels we attach to people perpetrating what we judge to be bad behavior within such systems. I certainly fell at times, as I'm just as much a product of the system as everyone else, but my ultimate goal is to dismantle systems, not exclude people. Well, that brings us to the tough part of my sermon. If we're called to accept all people, regardless of their flaws, regardless of their place in the system, must Unitarian Universalists tolerate all behavior? Well, for the answer, I go to an unlikely sage, country music singer Aaron Tippin. "You've got to stand for something or you'll fall for anything." Indeed, it can be tempting to take a position of moral relativism, that what is right is up to a person's individual interpretation of right and wrong, without any other considerations. Some would ask whether this negates what I just said. Well, no. A quote I've not been able to definitively source, but which I'm told comes from a Unitarian Universalist Association staff member, might put it best. "We accept all souls, not all behaviors." In other words, we don't label people, all of whom are flawed and mess up at one time or another. We do label ideas and behaviors. To quote my colleague Emily Wright Magoon, "It is a misconception that a Unitarian Universalist can believe whatever they want. It's correct that we're not a creedal faith. We do not all have to believe the same thing, but we are a covenantal faith. So if a person's belief causes them to relate to others in a way that falls outside our covenant, it ends up creating an unwelcoming environment for all." Someone say to say it again?
Say that again. Yeah,
okay. "It is a misconception that to be a Unitarian Universalist, you can believe whatever you want. It's correct that we are not a creedal faith. We do not all have to believe the same thing. But we are a covenantal faith. So if a person's beliefs cause them to relate to others in a way that falls outside our covenant, it ends up creating an unwelcoming environment for all. This doesn't mean that we shouldn't dialogue with people. This doesn't mean we should exclude people automatically. It does mean that our foremost priority isn't an interpretation of freedom and speech and democracy that requires us to sacrifice the emotional or physical safety of our members in favor of somehow pretending to hear all sides of an issue, an idea that will lead us down a relativistic route. No, like our reading this morning suggested, we need a place where we can go and feel safe in difficult times of our lives. A place where, as our Moment for All Ages suggested, we are encouraged to prune old ideas that are outdated and replace them with new. And the fact is, if there are no limits at all, people will not feel safe coming here. Those who no longer feel safe or accepted will simply leave the congregation, often without saying a word to anyone. And I debated whether to say it, but it's already happened. Few want to be a place where every idea on the free market is valued equally, where hate and misbehavior are tolerated on a regular basis. Because to quote psychologist Jeremy E. Sherman, if we tolerate intolerance, it spreads. I would expand this to any behavior that puts us at odds with the mission and vision of this congregation, as well as the seven principles of Unitarian Universalism. It's been suggested that the first two principles are the first two, because if your free search for truth and meaning leads you to violate the inherent worth and dignity of all people, or to act in ways that are not loving and compassionate, is it also a responsible search for truth and meaning? And we'll come back to that next month. So here's my answer to how I would respond if a white nationalist wanted to join our congregation. Absolutely, they are welcome. If they're willing to sign our book with all the obligations that come with it, I will encourage them to spiritual growth, as the second part of our third principle encourages us to do. I won't even label them a white nationalist, either in public or private, for I realize how problematic it is after I just talked about how problematic labeling people with "is" is, and I've had to do that several times in this sermon for clarity. However, that does not mean they get a free microphone to promote beliefs that are in violation of our way of being religious. No, not all ideas have inherent worth and dignity. They are welcome to worship with us. They are welcome to come see me for pastoral care. They can even talk about their beliefs. And they are welcome to find community within our walls. They're not welcome to use our congregation as a way to undermine the principles of Unitarian Universalism, as well as our mission and vision. The question will be asked, how do we decide what those limits are? The case of white nationalism seems an easy one, but for many behaviors and ideas, it might not be so clear-cut. Such as the case with a person convicted of sexual assault who says that they are reformed. I was told a story by a colleague in the process of writing this, that their congregation had to have a debate when a person who was convicted of setting two churches on fire wanted to join their congregation. Yeah, some limits were placed there. But it was not uncontroversial. For some questioned, does that mean we don't accept them? No, we just accept that human beings are human beings. I have no easy answers for you this morning, and there aren't easy answers. Some congregations have decided that pedophiles cannot be welcome in their congregation, and others have welcomed them with limited access. But I can tell you how our faith articulates these boundaries via covenant, which requires extensive dialogue and listening. We are a covenantal faith because we get to decide what limits we place on community and what we need to feel safe when we come together. A congregation without covenant is one that has implicitly said that they're not taking a stand on what behaviors are not welcome. And the paradox is, unless we identify which behaviors are conductive to community, we become an unwelcoming congregation. This doesn't mean we have to force people to start wearing scarlet letter A's. The mistake of the townspeople in the scarlet letter wasn't necessarily in standing against adultery. That's a topic for another sermon, and one that I have a feeling we'll all have different opinions on. But it was rather in condemning Hester as an outcast. But Aaron Tippin was right. You do have to stand for something, or you'll fall for anything. And our faith stands for something through its use of covenant, a topic that I hope the board and I will be coming back to in future months. I want to close with one more quote from Emily Wright Magoon, which illustrates beautifully one way of accepting one another and encouraging them to spiritual growth. Hospitality is welcome. Welcoming all into our covenant. It's about the radical kindness of telling one another when we need to get back into covenant. Sometimes it may not feel nice, but it is kind, because we all need help learning how to live. And the better we can relate to one another, the more healthier the communities we will be able to be a part of and help create, and the more mutually nourishing relationships we can enjoy. Our faith doesn't exclude the person. It doesn't label them or suggest we try to fix them. It does invite them into our covenant, our way of being religious, and we'll continue working to dismantle the systems those beliefs and behaviors come from while we're at it. May we be a community that engages in hospitality and nourishes relationships. Thank you.